morning, everyone. The last time I spoke, it was Mother's Day, right? And I made a big fuss over all the mothers and everything. Today's Father's Day. Huh? It's not Father's Day. Huh? Oh. Yeah, I got set up. Swami B, he just before we came, he said, "Say something today about Father's Day." So, okay, well, I'll be speaking on Father's Day next Sunday, anyhow. So I won't say anything then. The subject today and next week, this is a two-parter, is each is great in its own place. You will probably recognize the title. This is from Swami Vivekananda's Karma Yoga. When Swamiji came to the West, the first visit, he gave a series of 8 lectures, which were later compiled, put together, and they came out in a little book called Karma Yoga, a very wonderful book that has some of his most important lectures in it. And this, along with Raja Yoga and Bhakti Yoga and Jnana Yoga, form the 4 of his most important works. We call them the 4 yogas. You'll find these in the complete works, and they're all published separately also. The talks on Karma Yoga are especially important because Swamiji raised the level of Karma Yoga to something completely different. In fact, I heard one of our Swamis say once, we shouldn't even use this word Karma Yoga with regard to Swamiji, because Karma Yoga gives the implication we're doing some type of activity in a particular way so that it purifies the heart, so that the mind can reach a stage where we can have some higher experience. But Swamiji's Karma Yoga really is a new way of worship, especially with his emphasis on service to humankind, seeing God within all beings. So it really brings it to a completely different level, a way of worshiping God in human form. And we have so many wonderful statements that Swamiji made, that beautiful poem about the living God that emphasizes this idea that it's not a means to an end. The way Swamiji taught Karma Yoga is a way of changing our outlook in the world so that everything we do becomes worship, not just a means to realization. It becomes worship itself. So there are many aspects, of course, to Swamiji's Karma Yoga. We'll find that he emphasizes everything that we find in Gita, which is one of the most important texts we have for Karma Yoga. But this idea that the highest type of worship is not in a shrine or in a temple, but through service to all beings, seeing God within them, was really the gem amidst all of the teachings that Swamiji gave us about Karma Yoga. Now, the second lecture that Swamiji gave in this series was this one. Each is great in its own place, and it has several wonderful aspects to it. I particularly like this one lecture, because it talks about duty and the different types of duties that we have, and especially the grandeur of the householder, because we often find that our devotees look upon monks, they put us on a pedestal, and they think that, we're nothing, we're second-class citizens, that until we become monastics ourselves, we won't achieve anything. It's completely wrong. Swamiji, he shows the beauty of this householder life, and it's something that Sri Ramakrishna also emphasized so much. He said it's like someone carrying a huge bundle on their head, right, and still being able to do all of their duties. So Sri Ramakrishna also praised the householder life very much. He used to say, if a householder in the midst of all the responsibilities and duties and everything can find a little time to call on God, it's a wonderful thing. And a sannyasi, if a sannyasi doesn't call on God, it'll be a terrible thing. And if a sannyasi does a little meditation, a little worship, a little prayer and everything, it's no big deal. We're supposed to. This is. We have nothing else to do. So we find that there's the path of the householder. The householder who calls on God in the midst of all the duties is equally great. This is the theme behind this. Each great in his own place. So we'll see that the ideal of the monk, the monastic ideal, monk or the nun, and the ideal of the householder are equally great ideals. So this is what Swamiji wanted to emphasize, especially in this one particular lecture. Now, there's a reason for the confusion here and a reason for the devotees sometimes to feel that they're not leading the same type of ideal that the monks are. We find this confusion if we read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Sometimes Sri Ramakrishna will talk very fiery words of renunciation. We can't even imagine what he said when it was only the future monastics. You know, we read about that some weekends everyone would come, but sometimes during the week, just the young boys who were destined to renounce the world and become the future monks of the order, they would be there, and Sri Ramakrishna would say, "Now go lock the doors." He had the doors on all the different sides of his room, and no one will come in. And then he gave these fiery words of renunciation. We can't even imagine, because what we read when the householder devotees were also present is full of renunciation. So sometimes some of the householders would think, "Oh my God, what will happen to us?" Once Ramakrishna was talking to Narendra about the need to renounce everything. So the householder said, "Well, what about us? Can we achieve nothing if we don't renounce?" And Sri Ramakrishna said, "Don't pay attention to what I'm saying. This is between the two of us." So naturally there would be some confusion. When we read in Gita, for example, this was a tremendous dilemma within the mind of Arjuna. He was ready to renounce the world and go begging his food, live the life of a sannyasi, really, because he found the duty that he was supposed to do so frightening that he had to fight in battle against his own relatives that way. So that dilemma was there: which is better, to renounce everything and not cause harm to anyone, live a life of begging food and a life of calling on God, or better to perform one's duties in the world? And Sri Krishna, he sometimes would give two answers. So sometimes he would say, performance of duty is better, that you have to perform your duty, that without performance of duty, we can never reach the stage where we can renounce. Then other times he'll say, no, there are two paths. There are different types of people in this world, that there has to be a path for those who still have some desire to live in the world, who have some attachments or feel some sense of duty, and there should be a path for those who are ready to renounce everything. So we find that the entire Gita is a way for Sri Krishna to remove this doubt that Arjuna has, to try to show him that performance of duty is equally as great as the renunciation of duty. And we even have the very first verse of chapter 6, a very strong verse that will say that really those who live in the world and do their all their daily duties and responsibilities and obligations without attachment are the real sannyasis. And those who simply put on the robe and give up certain rituals and things, they shouldn't be considered sannyasis if they have attachment. So there's really a great deal of beauty and grandeur in the householder path, those who live in the world and call on God at the same time. Anyhow, this lecture that Swamiji gave is not really meant to compare which one is greater, but to show that each is great in its own place, and whoever, through karma or for whatever reason, chooses one path shouldn't feel that, oh, the other one is greater. Either way. So this is a very wonderful idea, and we'll see later that Swamiji gives a very beautiful story to help explain all of this. But I want to first start with this idea of duty, because this is one of the great themes of Karma Yoga. Dharma, swadharma. Swadharma means one's own particular kind of duties and obligations, and this is one of the main themes, of course, that we have in the Bhagavad Gita. A very important idea that Krishna himself is born only for the sake of dharma, of righteousness. If we don't have obligations and duties and we don't fulfill them, then everything falls apart, the whole fabric of society. So this was the whole reason why Krishna was born, the whole reason why he had to convince Arjuna to do his duty, because dharma was hanging in the balance. Dharma in the sense of righteousness. And it was Arjuna's duty as a kshatriya, of course, to fight in this battle. So Sri Krishna had to use all of his tricks. He had to explain to him the real nature of the self. He had to practically call him a coward. Really. He said, not that I'll call you a coward. Everyone else will call you a coward. So he did everything he could so that Arjuna would understand that he had to perform his duty. At the same time, we'll read in the same Gita that those who reach a certain stage in spiritual life where they rejoice in the self alone, atmarati, where they have this atmarama state, they have no duty anymore. They have no duty whatsoever to fulfill that way. And this was also one of Sri Ramakrishna's teachings. We'll find the same idea that when the daughter-in-law in the family becomes pregnant, the first few months she can still do all of the household duties. Then as it gets closer to the time of delivery, the mother-in-law lessens her duties completely. And then when it's time to give birth, she has nothing to do but prepare herself for that. And then after the child is born, just to play with the child and look after the child. So he says the Divine Mother herself will start lessening our duties and obligations as we proceed in spiritual life and get closer to this ultimate goal of God realization. So this is one of the great themes of this Gita, that Arjuna was in this great state of confusion, trying to figure out what his duty was. So we'll find it in various places. He'll say, first you praise renunciation of action, and then performance of action. Tell me conclusively which one is better. He keeps asking Sri Krishna, don't give me options. I want to know what to do. I'm confused. I'm taking shelter with you. I'm bowing, and I'm resting at your feet. I want you to tell me exactly what to do. And then Sri Krishna, he'll say, yes, this is better than that. You should do performance of action. There are two different types. Then he'll say, but really, it's only children, that means foolish people, who make such a big distinction, that the goal that is attained through performance of action and the goal that's attained through renunciation of action are the same, that each one will lead to the highest type of realization. So in Gita, it goes, it's a kind of roller coaster ride with this idea of dharma. So much emphasis on dharma, and then we'll find at the very end, give up all dharma. Sarva dharman parityajya. Give up all idea, I have to do this, I have to do that. Try to reach that state of spontaneity where there's no feeling of obligation. We do everything freely. We do everything as an offering. We do everything as worship at that point. Swamiji himself, he'll talk about this need to perform our duty and our obligations. Then he'll come out with the statement that the idea of duty is the midday sun of misery scorching the very soul. So this is a question of our own individual development. And duty can be a beautiful thing. It can be the way we worship. We offer all of the fruits of our actions through all of the duties that we perform. But we reach a point where even that becomes a burden to us, because there's not that perfect freedom there. So Swamiji could say something like that, that we long to reach that stage where there's no idea of obligation. Everything is perfectly spontaneous. Everything is done through love. Everything is done as a type of worship. So one of the main premises that we find in Swamiji's lecture is that duty is not absolute, that the duty is different from one individual to another individual based on their respective situations in life. Now, we know the ancient idea that we have in the early scriptures, the Dharma Shastras, is that duty is based on two different things. One is called ashrama, or stage of life, and the other is called varna, the caste that we're born into. And in Gita, we'll have all, especially with caste, there's a long section about the different duties that those who are Brahmins and Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, Shudras, all of that have different types of duties. But there are certain things that are in common for everyone. There are certain duties and obligations. One is a very general idea that we have to play our role in society, that we have to perform an action without the selfish motive, that we have to think what's for the good of everyone, not just ourselves. So there's some very universal ideas about disinterested action, non-attachment to the fruits of action, performing all action as yajna, as a type of sacrifice, as a type of offering. But then we get these specific teachings for all of the different castes. Now, the caste, of course, it has such a negative meaning nowadays, but if we think of it in terms of whatever our particular occupation is, if we're workers in an office, we have certain types of duties. If we work with our hands, if we are the people who serve that way, we have certain types of duties to do. This is really the main meaning that we have here. So we have a system whereby all different members of society have their own particular duties, but they all have to learn selflessness the same way. They all have to learn sacrifice, sacrificing personal desire for the welfare of the family, for the welfare of society, and if possible, do everything in this spirit of worship. And through that, one can reach the highest goal. This is not something that was always accepted. The jnanis will say, no, you have to have perfect knowledge. Karma yoga at best can purify the mind so that it can be subtle enough so it can realize the highest truth. The Gita is pretty definite that through karma yoga alone, a very strong statement, that Janaka and others have attained to that same state. And Swamiji also says that if we can be perfectly selfless, whether we believe in God or not, whether we do meditation or not, whether we do prayer or not, we can attain the same goal that the yogis reach, the jnanis reach, the bhaktis reach that way. So we'll see that this performance of action should not be looked upon as a secondary type of class. Gita puts far more emphasis on the performance of action than the renunciation of action, even up to the beginning of chapter 18. We'll find that the renunciation of obligatory action is not proper. There are exceptions. Those who really become mad for God, then of course they have nothing to do. Then they're free. But short of that, we all have our duties to perform. And if we perform our duty in the right way, it's a very beautiful thing. We do it with that spirit of love, without feeling that we're forced to do anything. That idea of obligation shouldn't be there. Now, when we go through this lecture, we'll find that Swamiji doesn't make much of a distinction between the different stages of life. This is the other way that we have this idea of dharma. The brahmacharya stage, the student has certain things to do. He's not expected to go out and get a job. He's expected to study. At that stage, he's supposed to learn what is the real meaning of dharma. What is it that we can have and understand as a ground and basis for the whole life to come. That means not just the householder stage of life, but the retired stage of life, and perhaps even the stage of sannyasa. So the grounding in spirituality has to be there, the grounding in dharma, and something practical, so that one has an occupation, one can do whatever is necessary to maintain a family at that stage. Then the garhasthya stage, grihastha, the householder. This is the stage where one is not only allowed, but one is supposed to fulfill desires and is supposed to get possessions. So we find kama and artha. This kama and artha become the two aims of life for the householder stage. Now, this confusion will come because Sri Ramakrishna over and over and over and over again talks about kamadi kanchan. Right? What is kamadi kanchan? Kama artha. The two goals of life that Sri Ramakrishna always rails against. He is always talking about lust and greed, lust and gold, that we have to renounce these two. So this confusion will come. We'll see later that Sri Ramakrishna, he looked upon the householder stage of life in a different way. He looked at it as an opportunity for those who were very close. And remember, when he's talking to the householder devotees, they're also very special. We know that the future monks were not just ordinary people. The householders were also not ordinary people. And he knew that some of these householders, later for Nag Mahashaya, some of the great householders, Bhadarambos, that they were capable of leading the life of almost a sannyasi, grihi sannyasi. He wanted them to remain in the world that way. So even for them, he would recommend this internal renunciation with a little bit of external renunciation also. So we'll see how Sri Ramakrishna almost redefines this householder stage of life. But in any event, this is the stage when we're allowed to fulfill our desires, we're supposed to, and we are definitely allowed to earn money. We shouldn't think, because Thakur talks about kanchan gold as a horrible thing and he couldn't touch it, we shouldn't think that the householder isn't allowed to earn money. Of course, has to. Swamiji is very strong on this. He says, a householder who does not struggle to get wealth is immoral. If he is lazy and content to lead an idle life, he is immoral, because upon him depend hundreds. If he gets riches, hundreds of others will thereby be supported. Of course, this means that we're not only creating work for other people, but not hoarding money. This is another important idea, that those who get money should give money. We have a very wonderful conversation in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna between Surendra Mitra. This was he was a very great householder disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, who in his early life was a little bit like Girish Ghosh. He was a drinker and a carouser, and he would run around and led a very wild type of life. When he came to Sri Ramakrishna, everything got transformed, because he had those samskaras. He was a very wonderful soul and very generous. He was the one who bore a large portion of the expense in Kashipur. And without him, we might not have our Ramakrishna mission today. Because after Sri Ramakrishna passed away, Thakur came to him in a vision and said, what are you doing? You see these young boys, they have no place to go. They do something for them. So he went to Narendra, who was already Swami Vivekananda at that time. And he said, I gave a little bit of money for Kashipur. I'm happy to give the same amount. Try to find a little place for all of the monks. You can all live there together, and we householders can come from time to time and get the benefit of your holy company. So because of this Surendra, we had the first Bharanagar Math. So the monks used to say, Adhanno Surendra, blessed is Surendra, that way. Now this conversation that took place, this Surendra, I don't know exactly what he did, but he did some work in an office. And Sri Ramakrishna had this idea that anybody who worked in the office had to tell lies. This was part of what it means to work in an office. I don't know, is it true? Tiny bit, not you have to, but there are times when it seems like this, you're almost forced to. Anyhow, so he said to him, you tell lies in the office, but I eat your food. Now, Thakur was so particular. If he thought someone didn't lead a very high moral type of life, he couldn't touch their food. He said, but I eat your food. Do you know why? And he said, you give more than you take. You're such a generous person that whatever defect there is in your character is overcome by your generosity and your charity. Then he gave a beautiful illustration. He said when they want to irrigate the farmland, the reservoir is usually a little bit higher, the farmland is lower, and they build a channel. So they have to make walls on the two sides so that the water can come in and flood the field. And Sri Ramakrishna said that sometimes the water comes in such a rush that it'll break the walls. So what the farmer does, he'll make holes in different places. So to relieve the great pressure, some of the water that's coming down will go out through the holes. And he said that the water that goes through those holes is very rich because it's taking some of that soil and fertilizing the land around it. So he said that the water that goes out serves a great purpose, fertilizing the land around, and it allows the rest of the water to go into the main field. So he said in the same way that those who hoard their money, the whole thing may break, but those who allow some of that to go out and help other people, then it benefits them and both. It benefits themselves and it benefits the other people as well. So we should see that each is great, whether it's the householder or the monk. The Swami Vivekananda says, the life of every individual, according to the Hindu scriptures, has its peculiar duties apart from what belongs in common to universal humanity. The Hindu begins life as a student, and then he marries and becomes a householder. In old age, he retires, and lastly, he gives up the world and becomes a sannyasin. Yeah, we got to the first two stages of life. Then we have the vanaprastiya stage, where the husband and wife together go into the forest or simply retire and spend their time in spiritual practice. And then the final stage of life, sannyasa, where they go their separate ways and live the life of being a mendicant, calling on God. To each of these stages of life, certain duties are attached. Not one of these stages is intrinsically superior to another. In fact, the scriptures praise the Grihastha, the Garhastiya stage, very much. The life of the married person is quite as great as that of the celibate who has devoted himself to religious work. The scavenger in the street is quite as great and glorious as the king on his throne. This is such a beautiful idea that it doesn't matter what we do, that every activity is necessary. What do we do if there's no one willing to do menial work? Everything will fall apart. Swamiji says in one place that if all the wealthy people of Calcutta stop work for a week, no one will notice. If the trash collectors stop for a day, everything will stop. So we should give everyone their due and their respect. That way, every worship is sacred. Every work is sacred. Every work is worship. So, the scavenger in the street is quite as great and glorious as the king on his throne. Take him off his throne. Make him do the work of the scavenger and see how he fares. Take up the scavenger and see how he will rule. It is useless to say that the man who lives out of the world is a greater man than he who lives in the world. It is much more difficult, this is what Sri Ramakrishna used to say, it is much more difficult to live in the world and worship God than to give it up and live a free and easy life like we do. The four stages of life in India have in later times been reduced to two, that of the householder and of the monk. Of course, we still have the retired stage and everything, but what Swamiji is saying is that if we think in terms of a choice, do I want to take this path or that path? It's basically these two. The householder marries and carries on his duties as a citizen and the duty of the other is to devote his energies wholly to religion, to preach and to worship God. So this becomes the basic distinction, even though we see these four stages of life and these four castes with their different obligations, this becomes the basic distinction between the householder and the monk. And this is what this lecture is about. Each is greater in his own place, the householder and the monk. This is something that's even stressed by Shankaracharya in his introduction to his commentary on this Gita. He talks about the two separate paths that are created at the very beginning of the world. The pravritti marga and nivritti marga. There's a path of activity. There's a path of engagement in the world. And there's a path of distancing oneself, removing oneself from the world, the path of renunciation. And that each person is born for a different path, that's all. And we shouldn't question it. We shouldn't think that, oh, if I were only like that person. We're like ourselves, that's all. And we follow the path that's best for us. There was a king. This is the whole story that we have, who used to ask everyone who came, all of the sannyasins that came to his kingdom, a question. This is how Swamiji starts this lecture. Who is greater, the all-renouncing sannyasin who gives up the world and its pleasures, or the householder who lives in the world and performs all his duties in a spirit of selflessness? Now, the sadhus would come, and they would give different answers. One would say one would say the other. And each time, the king would say, give me some proof. It's not enough you just simply say it. Why is this one greater than that, or why is that one greater than this? And if they were unable to convince him, then he would say, all right, you go marry, lead a householder life. So this is the premise of the story that we have. I don't know where it's from. Some of these things are from Mahabharata and other things. Swamiji doesn't say. Does anyone know? Anyhow, it's probably some old traditional story. Anyhow, one day a young sannyasin came, entered the kingdom, and they took him to the king. This was the practice that was done there. And when he was asked that question, who is greater, the householder performing duty or the monk who renounces everything, he said, each, O king, is equally great in his own place. Then the king said the same thing he said to all of the others. You show me. You have to prove it. So the sannyasin said, I'll demonstrate the truth of this statement, but you have to come with me. You have to come with me, live with me as I do for a few days, and then you'll understand why I made the statement that I made. So the king agreed. So they set off. They went to a far off kingdom, and they saw that there was a big hubbaloo going on. There's so many people there and dancing, and they could see there's some great ceremony was about to take place. So they went closer, and they found it was a Swayamvara. The Swayamvara. We think that in early India, women had no rights. But they got to choose their husband. Of course, this is the case of the princess, that she would stand there, and all of the potential suitors would come, those who wanted her hand in marriage. And she was very beautiful, and it was a very wealthy kingdom. So many, many young men came, and they had to show off. They had to show what good archers they were, what great scholars they were, and everything. She wanted a particularly handsome young man. So many came, and no one satisfied her. So this was the second or third time that this was going on. And she had a garland in her hand, and the practice was they would all come before her, and sometimes they would have a crier who would sing all of the praises of the potential suitor, and if she liked him, she would put the garland over him. That was the way she chose who would be her future husband. So this had gone on several times before. She never found the right person. And this time she also seemed to be very disappointed because she didn't care for anybody who came. But as this was going on, a second sannyasin came. who was young and very handsome, a very striking figure and everything. He didn't know what was happening. He went there and just out of curiosity to see, and he went a little bit close, and the princess saw him and how handsome he was and such a shining figure, and said, "Ah, this is the one," and quickly put the garland over his neck before he knew what was happening. Now, he was surprised, of course. He just went there out of curiosity. And so immediately he understood what was happening. He took the garland off. He threw it on the ground. And in disgust, he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Don't you know I'm a sannyasin? What is marriage to me?" Then the king thought, "Oh, perhaps he's a poor person and he doesn't know that that he'll get so much riches and wealth and everything." So the king started saying that, "If you marry her, I'll give half of the kingdom right now to you. And when I die, of course, you'll get the rest of it." Again, they put the garland around his neck. Again, he threw it down in disgust and walked off. So he walked very fast. In the meantime, the princess, she said, "No, I don't want anybody else." She had fallen in love with him, with love at first sight, and was prepared to follow him anywhere. So she took off. So the king, first king, and the first sannyasin, they said, "Let's follow. Let's see what happens here." Okay, because he's trying to convince him that each is greater in its own place. So as the young sannyasin went very quickly away and the princess followed, and they went to the woods, the first sannyasin and the king, they followed at a distance so they could see what was going on. After some time, the sannyasin entered into a deep forest, and he knew the forest very well, so he could lose all of them. So he's gone now. So now the princess is there all alone, and she just didn't see him, didn't know which way to go. She sat down under a tree. She felt very helpless. No one else knew how to find her. So the king and the sannyasin are watching her. And she was helpless. She simply sat down under a tree, and the first king and the sannyasin, they went and said, "We know the way out. We can help you." And she said, "No, now it's too late. What to do? And it'll be dark before we know it." So she decided that she would spend the night there, sleeping under that tree. So we have the three of them now. We have the king, first king, and we have the sannyasin, who's trying to convince him, and then we have the princess, all trying to sleep out in the wilderness just under the branches of a tree. Now, there happened to be a family of birds that lived in that tree. They had their nest in the top of the tree. The father bird saw that these three travelers were there under his tree. So they were like guests in his house. He felt that responsibility. One of the great concepts of dharma is this atithi devo bhava, that we look upon a guest as a god. So they thought, "Oh, we have three guests staying in our house. What can we do? How can we serve them? They'll be cold when it gets dark." So he flew off and somehow found a twig from a burning fire and put it in his beak and came back and put it in front of them. And then they understood that they could start a little fire. So they got some kindling wood and some logs, and they had a fire there. So at least they wouldn't be cold through the night, and animals wouldn't bother them that way. Then the father bird said, "But we have nothing to offer them to eat. What could they give? They can't give worms or anything." So he said, "They're very hungry. They'll have to pass the night without food. We are householders. It's our duty to feed anyone who comes to our home." Then, before anyone could realize, the other birds could realize, the wife and the chicks could realize, the father bird flew quickly into the fire, offering his own body into the fire, thinking that they'll be able to at least eat the bird, the flesh from that bird. Of course, they would never do it. They did whatever they could to save the bird, but it was too late. Then The mother bird thought, there are three of them and only one bird to eat. It won't be enough. So she also flew into the fire. Then the babes, chicks, they also looked on and said, this was the dharma of our parents. Now we have to follow their lead. And they also went. So these birds sacrificed themselves. The visitors looked on helpless. They couldn't do anything to stop it. So they were unable to save them. And of course, they couldn't eat them. So they spent that night sleeping there without fasting and sleeping that night. The next morning, the king and the sannyasin took the princes back home. It was light out, they could see the way. And then, as they were walking back, the sannyasin said to the king, King, you've seen that each is great in his own place. If you want to live in the world, live like those birds, ready at any moment to sacrifice yourself for others. If you want to renounce the world, be like that young man to whom the most beautiful woman in kingdom were as nothing. If you want to be a householder, hold your life as sacrifice for the welfare of others. And if you choose the life of renunciation, do not look at beauty and money and power. Each is great in its own place, but the duty of the one is not the duty of the other. Now, what we find in actuality is that there's a great deal of overlap. We've been talking so far about two very distinct paths, and it's true. They're very distinct paths and very different for people at different stages of life and different types of people. But probably it was a rare thing, even in ancient times, for the householder to end up really renouncing everything, to enter into the state of sannyasa. We have no way of knowing these things. If this was just some ideal formula, how many people actually did it? Probably retiring into the forest or retiring. That was common for many people, and that was the end of it. We have our Yajnavalkya, who gave up his two wives, Maitreyi and Katyayani. But this may have been a very rare thing at that time. But everyone has to pass through this student stage of life, and then that choice is there. There were different times, actually, in India where there were different theories. At one time, there was a theory of only three stages of life. They didn't count as sannyasa. And there was a time when they said that one could never become a sannyasi without becoming a householder first, because we have to go through this stage of kama and artha. We have to get rid of this desire for possessions and enjoyments. And we do that in the householder stage of life. And then there was the idea that first brahmacharya, then we have a choice after that. We decide to become monks and nuns, or we decide to become householders that way. But we find that the householder needs a little bit of the sannyasi, and the sannyasi needs a little bit of the householder. This is especially true when we see the type of sannyasa that Swamiji wanted to see, especially within the Ramakrishna order, where we have our duties, we have our obligations, where we live in the world, where we have to serve others, we have to use the same beautiful techniques of karma yoga and do everything as worship. And then we'll also see how Sri Ramakrishna wanted some of this renunciation to enter into the life of the householder. If the householder only cares for kama artha, for possessions and enjoyments, they're not prepared for the later stages of life. So these ideals are sometimes just models for us. In reality, we'll see that they overlap, and we need to incorporate them. So for Sri Ramakrishna, the life of the householder, the Grihastha, has to have a little bit of the sannyasi. That has to be there, a little bit of renunciation. And that means mostly moderation. Mostly moderation. That we don't expect the householder to I have no possessions, but the accumulation of possessions should never be the goal of life. So we see that each one tempers the other a little bit. And as I was saying, the sannyasis also have to have this idea of performance of action as worship of God. Because we don't live under trees. We don't wander from place to place. Holy Mother, sometimes these young monks would come to Holy Mother and they would complain that, we have to work in the office, we have to work in the hospital, we wanted to be monks while doing all of these things. So she would say, okay, Baba, if you like that, then live under a tree. You're provided with such a nice food and a place to live and you don't want to do anything for it. So we also have our obligations that way. She said, there are many sadhus like that. They'll wander from place to place. They have no duties or obligations. If you want to be that type of sannyasi, you can be that type of sannyasi. But don't try to get both. To have such a wonderful place to live and at the same time not do anything for the welfare of others. We see this wonderful spirit of this combined spirit of renunciation and sannyasa and performance of duty in some of the direct disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. I think one of the best examples is Swami Sharadananda. If we look at his life, it was really remarkable. He never became president of the order because Swamiji wanted him to remain as the general secretary. Actually, before Mahapurush Maharaj became president, they wanted him to be president. And he said no. Because for them, whatever Swamiji said was the final word. They always felt that if Swamiji said it, this was Sri Ramakrishna's will. So he remained as general secretary. Swami Brahmananda, when he was president all of those years, he was a great mystic. His mind was always someplace else. He oversaw everything in a very beautiful way, but he wasn't a detailed person. So the Swami Sharananda, he had to really look after all of the internal workings of the order. He lived most of his monastic life in a household of women because he had to bear the full responsibility for Holy Mother. And in her Bhag Bazar house, that meant that Yogan Ma was there, Golap Ma was there. Sometimes Western women were there also. For a large part of the time, Radhu, who was half crazy, and her mother, who was completely crazy, that they were living there. And he had to constantly worry about money. He had to raise money to pay for Udbodhan house. He had to raise money for Mother's new house in Jainabati, and then to come up with a temple for Holy Mother. So he had all of the same worries and obligations and responsibilities and duties of a householder, yet he was the ideal monk. He had perfect dispassion, perfectly calm, perfectly peaceful. So he was really the ideal monk for the Ramakrishna order because we try to emulate that to fulfill all of the obligations and duties, but without letting the mind get disturbed. There's one advantage that the sannyasi has. We don't have to worry that, what if we can't pay for this, that we'll be out on the street. We'll go to another center, that's all. We don't have that type of fear, but still, if we try to fulfill our duties, we want to do it in the best possible way, because it's all for Sri Ramakrishna and Holy Mother. We're doing everything for them. We're her foot soldiers, so we have that type of obligation. We had a very wonderful monk that was in charge of Jainabati for many years. His name was Swami Premarupananda. I don't know if any of you remember him or ever saw him. He was a cousin of Swami Lokeshwaranandaji. And he used to come to culture sometimes to visit or do some work in Calcutta that way. So I was there once, and we all went to his room, and we saw that he had a picture of Varanagar Mutt. You know that picture where all the monks are there in front of it and everything, and look very austere and everything. So we asked him about it, and he said, yes, wherever I go, I carry that picture with me. He said, wherever I go, even Institute of Culture, for a sadhu is a luxurious place. He said, I want to always remind myself that sannyasa means renunciation. and that we should have the same attitude as the monks who were living at Varanagore at the time. So anyhow, this is the theme of this lecture, that each ideal is a very beautiful ideal that the householder should learn from the monk should learn from the householder. And each one is equally great. We should never think that there's something special about the monastic life, that only the monks will have God realization. It's not like that. And this mixture of these two is seen so clearly in the life of Sri Ramakrishna and the life of Holy Mother. And they were married, after all, and Holy Mother had the whole household to look after. And yet they were ideal role models for us, for both performance of duty and for renunciation. So we will continue with this theme next Sunday and complete that. And I will wish everyone, all the men, a happy Father's Day next Sunday also. And now we'll sit for a few minutes and then we'll have a closing song. And then I'll give announcements.